Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. You've given us a lot to think about. I think that NATO's Secretaries General are frequent visitors to Washington. I don't think I've ever seen a visit where so much attention was paid. I was told that in your conversations with Congress today, you had a better attendance than has ever happened for a visiting NATO Secretary General. Obviously, it comes as an important time in this country as Americans are trying to figure out who will lead them into the next part of the 21st century. And your remarks on the subject of NATO's future address key questions about relevance, the why it matters part that you raised, that have obviously been front and center in the political debate here. So I want to talk about some of the specific initiatives that you outlined, but first would like to ask you, as a European who spends much of your time around European leaders, about that debate going on here. President Obama, who you met with this week, has repeatedly cited growing concerns expressed to him by Americans' allies about what he this week called some of the wackier suggestions being made by presidential candidates. Secretary Kerry spoke about it last night on television, again saying that European allies and other allies in the world, but particularly the Europeans, have expressed repeated concern to him. Many of the notions the president's referred to have specifically talked about the transatlantic alliance, both trade and defense, and suggestions about the value of NATO. So I want to ask you if you've heard these same concerns, and when you Europeans are sitting around among yourselves, when the Americans aren't in the room, and you really let your hair down, is that what you talk about? How much concern is there in Europe?
So I have less and less hair, so that's my my problem. But if you watch old pictures of me, you understand what I mean, because I had I was very different then. First of all, I would like to say that I welcome that it's more attention to NATO and NATO-related issues in the American political agenda. And that may be because of the election campaign. I will not be part of the election campaign. For actually decades, election campaign was an important part of my life. And it's very hard to not, part of election campaigns. But that's my previous life. Now I'm in some other kind of business, which is not addressing election campaigns, especially not in the United States. So it's up to the people of America to decide who is going to be the next president, and I will in no way be part of that discussion or that that campaign. But what I can say is that when I travel in different capitals in Europe, and you asked me about that, I see a very strong support for transatlantic cooperation, for the North Atlantic Alliance. I think that some of them actually understand that in the United States, people from different parties are concerned about that too many Europeans are investing too little in defense. And that's exactly why we made the pledge to increase defense spending. And that's exactly why I personally, every time I meet the political leaders in different European allied countries, urge them to do something with it. And that's also the reason why I welcome that at least last year they were able to stop the cuts. Also, to not reduce is not a very big achievement, but at least compared to continuing to cut defense spending, it is the first step towards moving in the right direction. And 2015 is the first year after we made the pledge in 2014. So it is the first step in the right direction after just 1 year. So I'm not certain whether you asked me about defense spending, but you asked me about whether Europeans are concerned. And they are concerned in a way that many of them understand that they have to contribute more to our collective defense, and that we don't have a fair burden sharing now. And that's also the reason why all 28 allies, all of the Europeans, agreed on the pledge we made in 2014 to step up their investments in defense.
Well said. Yeah. obviously, there are concerns about, in this country as well as in Europe, about how some of the conversation has been phrased about NATO. But the overall question, beyond the question of burden sharing, about NATO's relevance is not really a new one. Sometimes it's spoken of in monetary terms. Europeans are free riders. And I think you've addressed that just now and certainly in your remarks and shown that that situation, in fact, is improving. But more broadly, in the years since the Cold War ended, you've had a lot of foreign policy experts from George Kennan to Donald Rumsfeld questioning whether NATO should survive. And most of those concerns were based on the end of the Soviet Union. You spoke of the largest reinforcement of collective defense since the end of the Cold War. And certainly some of NATO's Eastern members have argued that the Cold War never really ended. General Breedlove spoke recently of a shift in NATO doctrine from assurance to deterrence, which I think in some ways is arguably a return to the past. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about Russia, what you think the actual threat is that Russia poses to the alliance right now. What are Putin's goals? Are his actions arguably a response, as some argued years ago, to NATO's expansion right to Russia's borders? Is there a limit that you see to, I'll say Putin, but Russia's desire to expand its own sphere of influence? Or do you see it, do you think they see it as a defensive mechanism?
I will say some words about Russia in a moment, but I will start by commenting on the introduction to the question, because that was also related to this concern whether part of the debate in the United States provides reasons for concern in Europe, that the United States is not focused on Europe, that the United States is not going to continue to be part of our transatlantic alliance and so on. So first of all, I would like to say that the first time I visited the United States was in 1980. And then I was 21 years old. And I visited the United States together with my father. He was then defense minister of Norway. And we traveled for a week around the United States at different military bases and different political think tanks and so on. I guess some of the people here are still, around. and then the main issue then was the concern about that the United States was not going to be supportive of Europe. And that was in 1980. So we have been concerned for many years, but we are still going strong. So it means that, of course, we shall always be a bit concerned. But at the same time, we have to see that we are able to deliver every day as a strong alliance, the strongest ever and the strongest in the world. And we are able to deliver deterrence, we are able to deliver collective defense, and we are able to stand together when it's really needed. So for instance, as I mentioned in my speech, the first time and the only time ever we have invoked the collective defense clause was after an attack on the United States. And then Europeans stepped up to help and support our ally, the United States. And one third of the forces, as I said, in Afghanistan, they have come from Canada, Europe, and European NATO partner countries. And more than 1,000 European and Canadian soldiers have lost their lives in Afghanistan. And many more have been wounded. So it's just a strong example of how European allies stand together with the United States when needed. Then, of course, I would like us to do more. Yes, so we will address defense spending and other issues. But the alliance is working. The alliance is delivering. We are providing deterrence every day. And we stand together in different operations and missions around the world. And we have done that every day since 1980, since I was concerned the first time. So I'm permanently a bit concerned, but quite successful. And that's a good, mix for the alliance. Then about Russia. We don't see any imminent threat against any NATO-allied country, including the countries in the eastern part of the alliance. But what we see is a more assertive Russia, responsible for aggressive actions in Ukraine and willing to use military force, not only invest in Russian military capabilities, but also the willingness to use those capabilities to intimidate neighbors, to change borders in Europe, annex Crimea, destabilizing eastern Ukraine, and having troops in Georgia, in Moldova, and so on. And this is, of course, of great concern. And that's the reason why we are responding. And when I say we, I mean United States and Europe together. Before, we didn't have forces in the eastern part of the alliance. Now we have forces there on a rotational basis. And we have so substantially increased our readiness to redeploy forces if needed. So again, I'm concerned, but as long as we are able to adapt, and because we are able to adapt, we are in a way responding to those concerns and making sure that the Baltic countries, all NATO allied countries, are safe because NATO is there.
But do you have a sense of what the ultimate goal is of Russia's actions as you try to strategize to provide this deterrent capability and this kind of show of strength? What is your sense of what they're hoping to achieve?
It's always dangerous to speculate too much, but what we see is that Russia is trying to re-establish a sphere of influence around its borders. And that's why they are behaving as they are in Georgia, in Moldova, in Ukraine. And that's not acceptable, because they are violating international law. They are not respecting the sovereignty and the territorial integrity, the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of independent nations, countries in Europe. And that's also the reason why it is important that we respond. At the same time, and we are responding by the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War. But at the same time, I always underline that NATO is not seeking a confrontation with Russia. We will avoid a new Cold War. Actually, we are striving for a more cooperative and constructive relationship with Russia. But we believe that we have to be strong, we have to be firm, we have to be predictable to establish the basis for a political engagement and dialogue with Russia. And I think I mentioned many times before, but my experience as a Norwegian politician is that there is no contradiction between strong defense and political dialogue. Actually, as long as we are strong, we can also engage in political dialogue. And in the long run, Russia has to understand that they will gain more from cooperating with us instead of confronting us.
You spoke about a new strategic reality that NATO's facing, the primary threat to security right now seems to be violent extremism and the spread of it in the world. You outlined what is not necessarily a new role for NATO, but certainly a broader expansion of that role and making it into a core capability for NATO, and that's the training and partnership institutional aspects of it. And you set out three ways of doing that. The first one was to build overseas capacities for countries on the front line against violent extremism. And obviously that's what NATO has been doing in Afghanistan, certainly since the end of the combat mission. But I wonder if you're concerned now about what's been happening in Afghanistan. General Nicholson, who's the new commander there, is getting his own recommendations ready for the administration about what the U.S. military presence should be after the beginning of 2017. And as you know, current plans call for it to be almost cut in half, the U.S. presence. But General Nicholson has spoken recently about how the training program really has been set back because of the level of fighting during 2015, which is one of the worst years that they've had, certainly in a long time, not only ground forces, but also forces in the air. Would you expect NATO forces, assuming that US forces remain there at their current level, Would you expect those NATO components that are still active in Afghanistan to do the same? What do you think is the likelihood that they would be, as some U.S. forces have been, dragged back into the fighting as it becomes more difficult there, and certainly as the fighting season starts to ramp up again?
The situation in Afghanistan is not easy, and actually it's very difficult. And I visited, as I said, Afghanistan just a couple of weeks ago. There is fighting. The Afghan National Army and security forces, they have also lost many soldiers. Taliban is trying to control different parts of the country, and we have many other groups, Al-Qaeda, different terrorist groups. We also have some ISIL in Afghanistan, and it's in no way an easy situation. But having said that, I think we also have to remember that it hasn't been easy in Afghanistan for decades. So the starting point is not a peaceful, stable country. The starting point is a country which was a safe haven for international terrorists, with Taliban in Kabul controlling the country. And what we have achieved is that we have been able, through the NATO presence there for many years, to build a strong national Afghan army and security force, which is capable, professional, and strong enough to take responsibility for the security in the whole country. That's not a small thing, that's a big thing. So we have been able to end our combat mission because we have enabled them to do the fighting. And I think very much that we should continue to enable them, continue to support them. I think it was a right decision of President Obama to maintain the current force levels through 2016. At the same time, the U.S. administration has and the president has announced that they will go from 9,800 or 9,800 to 5,500 by the end of the year. What we haven't yet decided in NATO is then what the other allies will do. That is something we will address and decide by the latest at our summit in July. Regardless, in a way, of what we finally decide when it comes to the scale and the scope of the rescue support mission, we have already decided that we will continue to support them also into 2017, but we haven't decided on the force levels, we haven't decided exactly on the scope of our presence in 2017 and beyond that. So I'm not able to answer you precisely exactly how our presence will be into 2017, but what I can say that we will continue to support them, continue to train them and advise them, and that we will continue to fund them. Because we have to remember that we are supporting the Afghan army and security forces in two ways. We provide training, assistance, with 12,000 NATO troops, but we also fund the national army with US funds and European funds and Japan, South Korea and others. NATO partners are also contributing. And we are concerned in Europe that we are spending less than 2% of GDP on defense. In Afghanistan, they spend 25% of GDP on defense. But of course, that's only possible because that is mainly funding coming from the United States, European allies and partners. So we will continue to support Afghanistan. Exactly how we will do it, we will decide on our summit in Wales, but we will continue to fund them and we will continue to have NATO presence because I very much believe that we have to enable forces in the region, in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, in North Africa, to stabilize their own countries. And in the long run, that's better than we deploying a large number of combat troops.
Just to continue on that theme of the of training as a core capability, you spoke about Iraq and the role, the expanded role that NATO could play there. There's been some suggestion that the coalition itself is sort of coalition of the willing, an ad hoc structure, really without any particular structure, and that perhaps this is a role that NATO could play, that NATO could take over some of the organizational aspects of training as well as putting the various components in place to do it, and that NATO could actually serve in a way that it has in Afghanistan as a kind of secretariat for that war. That seems to be what you were suggesting, that this could be NATO, that NATO could undertake a much larger role in addition to direct assistance to Iraq, in some ways organizing the activities, some of the activities at least, of the coalition there. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
The advantage of using the tool NATO, using NATO as a tool, is that in NATO, for instance, building capacity, train, as we have done in Afghanistan. And let me just add before I continue that if there was anything wrong we did in Afghanistan, then it was that we didn't start the training earlier. So we should have started to build capacity in Afghanistan earlier, enabling them to take responsibility for their own security earlier. But the advantage of using NATO is that NATO has the structures. We have mechanisms for generating forces. We meet regularly, several times a year, to generate forces to our different missions in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, in other places. And of course, if you are asked also generate forces to a training mission in Afghanistan, in Iraq, then we can also do that. So it's a stronger commitment when you are part of a NATO alliance and partner countries to provide the necessary forces than the commitment being just a part of a coalition of the willing, because a coalition of the willing is, in a way, per definition, more a question of whether you are willing, while NATO is a stronger commitment to be part of that. So we have the mechanisms to generate forces, and that's a great advantage, and I think also we can then provide more support for the United States. Second, we have the command structures, we have different training centers, we have some in Europe, we have we work with the Jordan in the King Abdullah training center in Amman, we will soon have the new center in Kuwait, and we have a lot of experience in doing training, capacity building, everything from building institutions, defense ministries, headquarters, institution building to training soldiers in a dangerous environment. And thirdly, we have the expertise, the experience. And I mentioned, for instance, this improvised explosive devices. The reason why NATO knows a lot about how to counter IEDs is that we have done that for many, many, many years in Afghanistan. So we could take that experience and apply it in, for instance, Iraq. But we will, of course, NATO will only do things which our allies ask us to do. And we have to find the right balance between high-end fighting, and I think the coalition should continue to do that. I mean, but I think that NATO can do more, coordinated with and add value and complement what the coalition is doing when it comes to training. Let me also add one more thing, and that is for many small and medium-sized countries, NATO allies and partner countries, it is often extremely expensive and difficult to do training on a bilateral basis in for instance, in Iraq. Because when NATO does the training, we have one agreement, one legal framework, and then you can plug into that. And we have, you know, infrastructure, transportation, and so on, organized as a NATO. And then small countries can just send in some special operation forces and do some training. I know my own country, Norway, it was for them a big task just to negotiate all the legal arrangements you need to deploy forces in Iraq. While when Norway deploys forces to Afghanistan, those things are in place, and Norway just plug into that framework. So I think it is also more cost effective. We spend less money, less meeting, less people on organizing many bilateral efforts instead of plugging into a NATO framework. So yes, you are right. I believe NATO can do more, but it has to be coordinated with the efforts of the coalition, and it has to be complementary. It has to be, done in a way which serves the purpose of the coalition.
Would you see that as taking over the existing bilateral training programs? You've got the Americans obviously have a huge effort there. Excuse me. The Canadians, the Italians, there are lots of different separate training programs that actually are doing different things with different groups of Iraqis to a large extent.
So I will rather speak about scaling up what we have started to do. We have started to train Iraqi officers. I would like to scale up that, and then I would like to also consider whether we also can start to do things inside Iraq. But I think it's very important that we do this in absolute coordination with the coalition, and that we, as I say, don't move faster than the coalition and the allies are, as I say, ready to do. So I think we should do it stepwise, and then evaluate the experience and then decide whether we should do more and what more. So the scale and the scope, I think we have to decide also step by step and then have a pragmatic approach. Because I think that, we also need the high-end fighting. We need to continue to do airstrikes. I'm not arguing in favor that NATO should take over that high-end fighting. I think that could be done by, and actually there are not so many allies doing that. It's United States, UK, France, and some others. But the thing is that, of course, we need high-end airstrikes to, for instance, help the Iraqi forces liberate Mosul. But the thing is that when Mosul is liberated, then the question is, how do you hold Mosul? How do you maintain the control of Mosul? And then you need trained, skilled, professional, local forces. And if that's not NATO forces, US forces, French or German forces, then it has to be local forces. And therefore we should start to attend them now and not to wait. Because if you wait, it just becomes more difficult and more expensive and in all ways not as good. And that's also the case when it comes to another kind of or group of countries. Iraq, it's a war going on. Jordan is a stable country. It's an island of stability in the sea of instability in the Middle East. But Jordan is under pressure. Tunisia, the same. A stable, democratic country in Northern Africa. But they are under heavy pressure from terrorist organizations. And we should help them now. We should not wait until they are really into deep trouble and then start to help them. Also, prevention is better than intervention. That's a golden rule. So we should help now, not intervene later on. So capacity building is also about building capacity before a country slides into conflict or crisis. And then if the country is in crisis, we should help them build capacity to get out of that crisis, as we should do in Iraq or hopefully also in Libya.
What about Syria? Do you see any role at all for NATO?
At the present, NATO's role in Syria is that NATO allies, but not as an alliance, are participating in the efforts of the NATO coalition, of the US-led coalition. And it is a great advantage for the coalition that so many NATO allies and NATO partner countries have been able to provide forces, because NATO has developed what we call interoperability, experience to work together in high-end dangerous military operations. And we have developed that through NATO exercises, NATO standardization, and of course, operations like in Afghanistan. And this experience, this interoperability developed among NATO allies and partners is extremely useful for the coalition in Syria now. And then, of course, we are also, what should I say, responding to the conflict in Syria by supporting Turkey, also bordering Syria and Iraq. We have assurance measures, NATO presence in Turkey, and everything we do related also to also stabilizing the region is also relevant to Syria, but we don't have a direct role inside Syria.
I'd like to open the floor to questions now. If you could, I will call on you, and if you could, are there microphones? Yes. And identify yourself, and hopefully ask a quick question so that we can have a lot of response here. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, Carl Venmark from CSIS. Pleasure to hear your comments, Secretary General. I was wondering, you talked about how NATO can work closer with regional allies to stabilize fragile states. And I was wondering if you see a role for some of NATO's partners. I'm thinking of Sweden and Finland, for example, in particular, who have unique state building and security sector reform capabilities. Is there a role for them here? And would that be a way to closely integrate them into NATO and even getting them sort of persuade them for a membership in the long-term road rather than having sort of the classic Russia debate? Would this be a way of making them more closely integrated into the NATO network? Thanks.
I absolutely see a role for Sweden and Finland joining our efforts to build capacity in North Africa, the wider Middle East region. And Sweden and Finland is already contributing, and I welcome that very much. And that's one of the advantages of NATO, is that we have proven our ability to mobilize partner countries. For instance, in Afghanistan, Sweden and Finland have participated and contributed a lot. So I welcome that very much, and I would like to see more of that. And again, this is important for the missions where Sweden and Finland participates, but we also have to understand that a way we are really developing our ability to work together with Sweden and Finland, the interoperability, is through big military operations like Afghanistan and perhaps also other places. And yesterday I visited Fort Bragg and I met with the 82nd Airborne Division. And they told me about how they have been able to develop interoperability, also ability to work together with different military units by being stationed in Afghanistan and working with NATO allies, but also with Sweden and Finland. Whether this will, have any impact on the membership debate in Sweden, I don't know. But I have said before that I have lost two referendums in Norway trying to convince Norwegians to join the European Union. So you should not ask me for advice on how to convince the Swedes to join NATO. That's on the level of taxi driving. So it's...
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Rahim Rashidi with Kurdistan TV. Is it what are Russia and Iran's roles in Syria? Thank you. And your opinion of Kurdish forces Peshmerga role in fight against ISIS? Thank you.
The Peshmerga forces play an important role, and many NATO allies and partner countries are providing training for Peshmerga forces as a part of the efforts to degrade and destroy ISIL. So I think that that's an example of how we are building local capacity. We do that already, but what I'm arguing in favor of is to do that more and in a more organized framework, more cost efficient and with greater impact. Russia's role in Syria is that they, and also Iran, is that they support the Assad regime. And they have declared that very clearly. And they have done that by deploying military forces in Syria. Even though there has been some reductions in the Russian presence, Russia still have substantial military forces in Syria. Air forces, ground forces, and naval forces in the eastern Mediterranean. So the main role of Russia in Syria is to support Assad.
Wow, so many of you. Yes, ma'am. I told you NATO was a hot topic now.
I'm from GCC. I am from UAE. And I want to ask you about how do you evaluate your relation with GCC in terms of cooperation. I believe they look for more from NATO rather than just building their capabilities. Can NATO assure them stability and security in the region vis-a-vis the Iran? And the other question is, how much can you give NATO and projecting stability in the region? How much from 10 you give mark for NATO in the Arab region and projecting stabilization?
Well, As I said, I very much believe that we can expand, enhance our cooperation with the Gulf Cooperation Council. And I visited the United Arab Emirates a couple of weeks ago. And I think that, in a way, by helping countries in the region to stabilize the region, we are, of course, also making the countries more secure. The whole idea is that if our NATO's neighborhood is more stable, they are more secure, and we are more secure. So it's not, in a way, security is nothing you get less of if you share it. You get more security if you create security together. So I strongly believe in us working together with the GCC. I also believe that the GCC countries can help us working jointly, for instance, with fighting ISIL, with building capacity in a country like Iraq. So for me, we have to do many things at the same time, and we have agreed that we will start to step up, and hopefully we will be able to make decisions related to this at our summit in Warsaw.
Yes, in the back, way in the back, the lady in the red.
I'm Lieutenant Colonel Sylwia Szabowska from the Polish Embassy. Just wanted to ask you quick questions. First, regarding political dialogue with Russia, what conditions must be fulfilled to fully for full resumption of NRC works? And do you think it should be somehow balanced with increased cooperation with the Ukraine and Georgia? The second question is as for the realignment of NATO efforts to increase the presence on the eastern flank with the American ERI initiative. And the last one, is there an appetite in the NATO for more to look on the Arctic challenges? Thank you.
First, NRC, or the NATO-Russia Council. I think it is important to underline the following, and that is that after the illegal and illegitimate annexation of Crimea in 2014, NATO decided to suspend all practical cooperation with Russia, but we decided at the same time to maintain our political dialogue with Russia, or maintain chance for political communication. So the NATO-Russia Council has never been suspended. Actually, we had two meetings in the Council after the annexation of Crimea. So the whole idea is that practical cooperation has been suspended, political dialogue has been in place. So the challenge now has been have a decision to have the NATO-Russia Council, because it has been there all the time. But the challenge has been to agree on the agenda for a new meeting. And we are in the process of discussing that with the Russians. And hopefully we will be able to agree on the agenda and then to convene a meeting. Let me underline that for me, dialogue is not an expression of weakness. It is an expression of strength, because it is because we are strong, it's because we are confident that we are not afraid of talking to the Russians. Even during the Cold War, we talked to them. And I think it's in our interest to talk to them on many different issues, especially risk reduction, transparency related to military activity. I think, for instance, that the downing of the Russian plane over Turkey just underlined how important it is that we do our utmost to have military-to-military communications, to have transparency, predictability, to avoid that kind of incidents. We have to try to avoid them, and if that happen, we have to make sure that they don't spiral and come out of control and create really dangerous situations. So dialogue is not weakness, dialogue is strength. Sorry, it was two more questions. I forgot them. Now, the eastern part of alliance. Well, we are in the. So we decided at our defense ministerial meeting in February to have increase our military presence in the eastern part of the alliance, the Baltic countries, Poland, perhaps also Romania, Bulgaria. Exactly the scale and the scope is not yet decided. We are working on that now. But what we are aiming at is a multinational force sending a very clear signal that an attack on one Baltic country or one other NATO allied country will trigger the response from the whole alliance. The Arctic. It's cold there. The other thing is that, you know, when people say Arctic, many people think about the North Pole. But half of my own country is in the Arctic. So half of Norway is in the Arctic. And there are, as I say, I've seen many nice people up there. And some polar bears and so on. But because the reason why I'm saying this is that NATO is present in the Arctic. And in a way, the main NATO forces in the Arctic is Danish forces, Icelandic, or not so many Icelandic, but at least Norwegian forces. And of course, we have also then NATO exercises in the northern part of Norway. Forces from many NATO allied countries. We had a big exercise in the northern part of Norway, recently. And so NATO is present in the Arctic, and we have to follow the developments very closely because we have seen also a Russian military buildup in the Arctic. At the same time, we have the Arctic Council. Where United States is a member, Canada is a member, Russia, Norway, Denmark, many other countries, or several other countries. We have also a degree of cooperation in the Arctic related to search and rescue, environmental issues with Russia. I think it's extremely important that we continue to do that and we don't increase tensions in the Arctic, but try to calm the tensions.
I'm gonna ask people to just limit themselves to one question. The questions have been really good, but maybe we can take two or three at a time if you limit yourself just to one. So yes, sir, and then I'm gonna come around this way.
Thank you, Ahmed from Al Jazeera TV. Turkey, there are so many voices that are saying that the NATO would be better off without Turkey. They are claiming that Turkey has betrayed the alliance, is helping, collaborating with ISIS in a way or another, is fighting the Kurds who are fighting ISIS, which is fighting the West. How do you comment on that?
I'll take one more. Yes, sir. Yes. Go ahead, Bill. We'll get the.
Bill Drozdiak, Brookings. General Breedlove said recently that he felt the Russians were weaponizing the refugee situation with the aim of destabilizing Europe. And I know NATO has sent some sea patrols into the Aegean recently, but my question is, why did it take so long for NATO to respond to such a serious security threat to the European continent when Greece and Turkey, both frontline states, are members of NATO?
Those are two hefty questions. So.
Two questions. First of all, the problem is normally not too many questions, but too long answers. So, but it's hard to be very brief because the questions are important and demanding. First, on Turkey. Turkey participate in the coalition fighting ISIL. Turkey provides military assets, but in addition, Turkey provides infrastructure, bases, the Incirlik base, and other facilities for the efforts of the coalition fighting ISIL. So without Turkey, it would have been much more difficult to, for instance, conduct many of the airstrikes and so on fighting ISIL. Second, Turkey is the NATO ally most affected by the influx of refugees. They host more than 2 million close to 3 million perhaps refugees. And so Turkey is heavily affected by the crisis in Iraq, Syria, ISIL. When it comes to the NATO's role in addressing the migrant and refugee crisis, so NATO's main role has been to address the root causes, the instability in the region, trying to help stabilize the countries where the refugees are coming from. When it comes to the to managing or handling the refugee crisis in Europe, NATO is normally not the first responder, because this is about, you know, border control, coast guard, border controls, that humanitarian also aid and so on to the refugees. But when we were asked, we responded. And we actually responded very quickly, because Germany, Turkey and Greece asked NATO for help, and after 48 hours we were able to make the decision to provide the ships and assistance they asked for. And 24 hours after we made the decision, the first NATO ships were deployed into the Aegean Sea. So for me, this is an example of how NATO can respond quickly if needed. And what we have done since is that we have several ships there in the vicinity of Lesbos and also a bit further south. And they are doing reconnaissance, surveillance, monitoring, and they are sharing in real time the data they are gathering with the Greek Coast Guard, with the Turkish Coast Guard, and with the European Union border agency Frontex. And this information is useful for instance, the Turkish Coast Guard when they are now then turning back and intercepting the traffic of the smugglers and the illegal networks. So I think NATO plays a useful role helping the local Coast Guards authorities. NATO is not in the business of turning back the boats with the refugees and migrants. Our role is to help, assist, facilitate. Add to that, that perhaps the most important thing NATO is doing in the Aegean Sea is to create a framework, a platform for cooperation between Turkey and Greece. Turkey not being member of the European Union, but Turkey and Greece both being member of NATO. So NATO is an ideal platform for providing the necessary cooperation between Turkey, Greece and the European Union.
There was something about Russia at the beginning of that question that you asked.
That was about what Russia did, especially also when they were bombing Aleppo, was of course to increase the number of people fleeing Syria, and increasing the pressure on Turkey and on, what should I say, Europe. I'm very glad, I welcome very much that some weeks ago United States, Russia and other actors in the region were able to reach this agreement on cessation of hostilities. And even if we have seen violations, hostilities have gone substantially down. And we have also seen that the parties have been able to meet again and start negotiations and try to find a negotiated political solution to the crisis in Syria. That will not be easy. It will not happen very fast. There will be setbacks and disappointments. But in the long run, we need a negotiated political solution. So I strongly support those efforts, both to make sure that the ceasefire is holding and to make sure that they continue the negotiations and the talks to find a political solution.
Yes, sir, I know I cheated you before, so you go ahead, and then, yeah.
Thank you. Meto Koloski, United Macedonian Diaspora. You mentioned Russia violating international law. If you could comment perhaps on Greece's violating international law after blocking Macedonia's NATO membership in 2008. Greece has a fairly new government in place. Macedonia may have a new government starting June. What role will your office play in facilitating improving relations and finally lifting this blockage on Macedonia's NATO membership, particularly on this point that you made before, Europe whole, free, and at peace?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Karen. Farah Al-Atassi, I am a member of the Syrian opposition delegation to Geneva. I'm here. You already spoke enough about Russia's role in Syria, and I was waiting to hear the NATO's counter-strategy to at least having some balance of power on the ground. But I will not ask you that question. My question is, there have been recently an efforts by the GCC led by Saudi Arabia to establish the Islamic coalition against ISIS. Will NATO partner, if they asked, with this new formed Islamic coalition against ISIS for a direct military intervention in Syria? Yes or no? Thank you.
If the question was whether NATO is going to conduct a direct military intervention into Syria, the answer is no. But if the question is whether we are going to work together with the Islamic coalition to counter ISIL, then the answer is yes. Because I welcome that Islamic countries are going together to fight ISIL. And I think it's extremely important that Islamic countries are in the forefront. And as, for instance, King Abdullah of Jordan has underlined again and again, this is not a fight between the West and the Muslim world. This is a fight against terrorists, criminals, people are responsible for violent atrocities, and most of the victims are Muslims. So Muslims are in the front fighting ISIL. And again, my main message is that we should support, we should help, we should enable, we should train, we should assist, we should help them in many different ways to win that fight against ISIL. So if you ask me whether we should help the Muslim world, Muslim forces, Muslim countries to fight ISIL, is this strong yes? That was the last question. The first one was about the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. And the reason why I say it like that is that you know and I know that the problem has been ever since the NATO summit in Bucharest. I was there as Prime Minister of Norway, has been that we don't have an agreement on the name issue. And as long as that issue is unsolved, there is no way we can solve the question of membership. That's, in a way, the short answer.
I think we have time maybe for two more. Kevin? And these... All right, and then in back of you over there.
Robert Dumitrescu, Embassy of Romania. As a country on the eastern border of NATO, we are highly appreciative of your leadership in addressing the key issues of reinforcing the eastern flank. How do you see this reinforcement process from a Black Sea perspective, a region that has multiple strategic challenges, both from the east and from the south? Thank you.
Hello. Through the podium, I'm Kevin Baer with Defense One. Last week, Secretary Carter at CENTCOM said that the U.S. was talking to NATO about joining the counter-ISIL coalition as NATO for the first time, which would be a change. So I'm wondering what would that involve beyond advise and assist? You just said that NATO would assist with the counter-ISIL campaign. Would that involve on-the-ground troops, special operators, ARC? What else besides the advise and assist mission?
First, Romania. The Black Sea is very important, and we have seen that Russia is developing what the experts call A2AD, or anti-access area denial capabilities, and they are deploying those capabilities, for instance, in Crimea. And we see a pattern all the way from the Barents Sea, the Baltic Sea, down to the Black Sea. And of course, one of the reasons why we are increasing our presence in the eastern part of the alliance, why we are increasing the readiness of our forces, and why we are also developing our capabilities, is that NATO has to be able to overcome those A2AD capabilities, which we also see in the Black Sea. Our maritime presence is important, and part of the high readiness force we have established, we also have a maritime component there. We normally speak about this high readiness brigade, but there is an air component and there is a maritime component, and that's part of our response to what we also see in the Black Sea. So yes, we are very much aware of the challenges in the Black Sea, becoming more serious because of the Russian annexation of Crimea and the strong military buildup in Crimea. Then, so NATO is not formally part of the coalition, but NATO supports the coalition. First of all NATO allies provide forces. And then, as I said, NATO support the coalition in different ways. Assurance measures in Turkey, capacity building in Iraq. I will also add that what we do in Afghanistan, our biggest military operation ever, is relevant for the fight against terror, including against ISIL. And we stand ready to do more in Libya, which is also key when it comes to preventing that Libya becomes a kind of build-up area for ISIL. One issue we have discussed, and also discussed during my visit here to Washington this week, and also with Secretary Ash Carter, was the possibility of NATO providing AWACS support, our surveillance plane. And that is on the table now, and it's going to be addressed in NATO, and then we will be able to provide you with a more precise answer. But AWACS support in one way or another is now an issue which is discussed in the alliance.
We promised the Secretary General that we would get him out of here on time, and I apologize to everyone whose questions we didn't get to. Thank you so much. I think the fact that there are so many questions testifies both to relevance and level of interest, and we've still managed to cover an enormous amount of ground. And thank you so much for your candor and for the completeness of your answers. Thank you.
Thank you.